Welcome to the Mental Minute, an AI-generated podcast. Today, we're going to be diving into moral hazard.
Okay.
It's something that you might have heard before, especially when people talk about finance or insurance. And you can think of it like this.
Okay.
When you don't feel the full weight of a risk, you're more likely to take it.
Right.
So it's about that gap between making the risky move and then actually having to pay the full price if things go wrong.
Exactly. Imagine you've got a kid who knows that their parents will pay for a broken window if they're playing ball in the house.
Uh-huh.
That kid is way more likely to take those crazy shots
than
if they knew that they had to pay to replace the window themselves.
Yeah.
So that's really the core of moral hazard, this like boosted appetite for risk when you know that someone else is going to pick up the tab.
So it's not necessarily about being like a bad person or wanting to cheat the system or something?
Not at all, no. It's often really about information. The person taking the risk usually knows more about what they're doing than the person who's left holding the bag if everything falls apart.
Okay.
Like, think about a manager at a company making investments with the company's money.
Okay.
They might be, you know, trying to chase a big bonus based on short-term gains, even if those investments are super risky for the company in the long run.
So they get the upside, but the owners of the company end up with the downside.
Exactly. And you know what? This isn't actually a new idea.
Oh, right.
This term moral hazard has been around since like the 17th century.
Right.
And by the late 1800s, English insurance companies were using it all the time.
Yeah.
But often with a negative spin, you know, kind of implying that the person with insurance was being dishonest.
So back then it was kind of a like a character flaw almost.
Yeah, initially. Yeah. But here's a twist. Around the same time, 18th century mathematicians were using moral to mean subjective. So you've got this other layer there, like this personal assessment of risk. But then things shifted. You know, in the 1960s, you've got economists like Kenneth Arrow coming in and they're looking at this concept again.
Yeah.
But they're not so focused on, you know, who's behaving badly or not.
Right.
For them, moral hazard was all about how the, you know, inefficient things can get.
Yeah.
When risk is moved around and people can't properly judge it.
Okay.
So it became more about the structure of incentives, sometimes linked to this idea of utilitarianism, like maximizing overall well-being. And it's worth remembering that in insurance, sometimes what people are calling moral hazard is actually adverse selection.
Oh, adverse selection. That sounds like a whole other topic.
Yeah, well, think about it this way.
Okay.
Moral hazard is about how you behave after you get insurance.
Uh-huh.
Like being a little less careful with your phone because you know it's insured.
Yeah.
Adverse selection is about who is more likely to buy insurance in the first place.
Okay.
Someone who's already high risk, like they've got a pre-existing condition for health insurance.
Right.
Or they live in a flood zone.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, okay, let's talk about finance. The 1998 bailout of long-term capital management.
LTCM. Yeah, that always comes up.
It does.
When you talk about
because the Federal Reserve stepped in.
They did to help LTCM's creditors
avoid
huge losses.
Right, and that kicked off this huge debate.
It did, because people were worried that it sent the signal to other big players that if you took on enough risk and things went bad, the Fed would come and rescue you.
So it's like having a safety net and you feel more comfortable jumping from higher up.
Exactly. Even Alan Greenspan, who was running the Fed at the time, he admitted that there was a moral hazard risk.
Okay.
But he argued that he had to act to protect the whole, you know, global financial system.
Right.
And, you know, economist Paul Krugman, he sums it up really well. Moral hazard is when the person deciding how much risk to take isn't the one who has to bear the cost if it fails.
Right.
And financial bailouts can kind of set that up. They can tempt lenders to take riskier bets.
Yeah. It's like this no-win situation where you want to prevent a huge meltdown, but at the same time, you might be setting up the next one.
Yeah. It's a delicate balance, and lending always involves risk. The loans with the biggest potential returns are often the riskiest ones.
Yeah.
But when taxpayers or depositors end up having to pay the price for those risky decisions, it can really distort how the market works and encourage excessive risk taking.
And that brings us to the subprime mortgage crisis.
Yeah. Which I think for a lot of people, that just screams moral hazard.
It really does. So how did that play out?
Well, many argue that the way mortgages were bundled up and sold off securitization, that really contributed to the problem.
Okay.
So with private label securitization, the companies packaging and selling these mortgages, often they pass that default risk on to investors.
Okay.
So they had less skin in the game. They didn't care as much if the mortgages were actually sound.
Because if the borrower couldn't pay, it wasn't their problem.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now contrast that with agency securitizations by groups like Ginnie Mae, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac.
Okay.
They kept the default risk. So they had a strong incentive to monitor those loans and really focus on quality.
Yeah.
And Mark Zandi from Moody's Analytics, he pointed to moral hazard as a key cause. He argued that because the risk was spread so thinly, no one felt truly responsible for making sure that each loan was okay. And the rapid growth of these less regulated finance companies, you know, that just added fuel to the fire.
And it wasn't just the lenders, right?
No. Borrowers can get caught in the moral hazard trap, too.
How so?
Well, if they don't feel like they're directly responsible for those immediate costs, you know, like with those huge credit card limits, they might overspend.
Okay.
And, you know, as we were talking about before, the structure of mortgage securitization starting back in the 80s, where risk was constantly passed along, meant that there wasn't always someone clearly checking if those loans were actually solid.
Okay, so now it sounds like the incentives were just all messed up.
Yeah, they were. They were.
So I read something about accounting rules potentially playing a role in moral hazard, too.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, can you explain that?
So there's a report from 2017 that highlighted that IFRS 9 and 13, which are international accounting standards.
Okay.
They give companies a lot of leeway in how they value their assets.
Uh-huh.
So the concern is that if companies know they have this flexibility in how they report potential losses, they might be tempted to take on risky investments.
So they can kind of hide the potential downsides.
Potentially, yeah. And because of this, banking regulators have introduced stricter rules about how banks have to value their assets to limit that discretion and reduce the risk of banks, you know, taking on too much risk.
Okay, so we've talked about a few ways that moral hazard showed up in the 2007-2008 financial crisis.
Yeah.
Were there any other specific examples?
Definitely. You know, think about asset managers.
Okay.
They often get paid a percentage of the profits they make.
Right.
So that incentivizes them to take bigger risks.
Mm-hmm.
With other people's money.
Because they get the reward if it works out, but they're kind of protected if it doesn't.
Exactly. Then you've got the mortgage loan originators. They often got paid per loan they made.
Right.
So they were pushing through as many mortgages as possible, even if they were risky, because they weren't going to be the ones holding those loans.
Right.
And then there's the too big to fail banks.
Yeah.
The idea that the government wouldn't let them collapse might have led them to take bigger risks, figuring they'd be bailed out if things went south. You know, and the LTCM bailout might have reinforced that belief.
Right. And the official inquiry into the financial crisis did say that moral hazard was a factor.
They did. Yeah.
But there is a counter argument to this idea that moral hazard was the main cause of the 2008 crisis.
There is. Yeah. Some people argue that bailouts only happen after companies have already experienced big losses.
So expecting a bailout wouldn't necessarily make companies immune to pain. And there's also evidence that suggests that a lot of big banks didn't actually see the crisis coming. Yeah. They weren't necessarily counting on a bailout. Others say that problems with corporate governance, where risky investments might have benefited the company's executives, but hurt society as a whole, were actually a bigger driver of the crisis.
Okay, so let's switch gears to the insurance industry, where this whole term originated.
Right. Back to the roots.
So it sounds like moral hazard has been a worry in insurance for a long time.
Oh, yeah. Insurers have always been concerned that having insurance might encourage people to take more risks.
Right.
You know, someone with fire insurance might be a little less careful about leaving candles burning.
That makes sense. Because the insurance company can't perfectly monitor what everyone's doing.
Exactly. That's that information asymmetry again. And it's important to distinguish between moral hazard and adverse selection.
Right. We talked about that earlier. So in insurance, moral hazard is basically people being less careful because they know they're covered.
Yeah. Their behavior changes in a way that makes a claim more likely or more expensive.
Right.
Because they're not bearing the full cost of the consequences. And this can happen in two ways.
Okay.
You've got before the event, moral hazard, like driving more recklessly.
Yeah.
Because you've got car insurance. And after the event, moral hazard, getting more expensive treatment after an injury because you have good health insurance.
Okay, that makes sense. So how do insurance companies try to prevent moral hazard?
Well, they use things like coinsurance, where you pay a percentage of the cost. Co-payments, where you pay a fixed amount each time you use a service, and deductibles, where you pay an initial amount before your coverage kicks in.
Right.
All these make the insured person share some of the cost, which reduces their incentive to overuse services or take unnecessary risks.
So if health insurance made everything free, people would probably go to the doctor a lot more.
Yeah, they probably would, yeah.
So it sounds like moral hazard isn't just a finance problem.
No. It's this core idea in economics. It's a fundamental concept in microeconomics and agency theory, which looks at those relationships between, you know, bosses and employees or clients and agents.
Right.
It's central to contract theory, too, which examines how those hidden actions after a contract is signed can lead to moral hazard. And the economist Bengt Holmstrom, he explained that moral hazard arises whenever risk is shared but one person's actions, which can't be observed.
Right.
Affect the probability of a bad outcome. Economic theory also separates ex ante moral hazard, which is the change in behavior before something happens, from ex post moral hazard, which is the change after, both stemming from that information gap.
Mm-hmm.
And we have these economic models like the ones developed by Hart and Holmstrom that explore situations where actions or information are hidden. And these models often show that we can't always reach the perfect outcome, you know, because people might be risk averse or they might not have enough money to cover potential losses.
So in business management, how does moral hazard play a role?
Well, in managerial economics, it often shows up when employees might slack off or take unnecessary risks, knowing that the company will be responsible for the negative consequences.
Okay.
So to manage this, companies use things like performance-based bonuses, monitoring systems, and careful hiring practices to try and align everyone's interests and reduce that temptation for risky behavior.
So it seems like moral hazard is this powerful force that's shaping decisions across the economy.
It really is. From what insurance we buy to how global banks operate.
Right.
And understanding that disconnect between who's taking the risks and who ends up bearing the costs can give you a whole new perspective on economic behavior and decision making.
It really makes you think, where else in our everyday lives might this dynamic be quietly influencing things in ways we don't even realize?